Right, guys, and welcome to the first issue or the first edition of the new Ring Chat with myself, Tris Dixon, joined by Dougie Fisher and Tom Gray, guys you will know well from the Ring staff. Guys, it's great to have you here to chat to. Dougie, obviously, it's been a relatively active weekend on the boxing in the boxing landscape, but I think we're still catching our breath from Michael Conlon's exhilarating attempt to dethrone Lee Wood last week. What was your take home from that fight?
My take home is I should have been watching that one live. I don't know what I was thinking. I didn't think that it would be the barn burner that it was. And I had some smart people tell me that Conlon would step it up, that it wouldn't be the Conlon that I've seen in previous bouts, who was, you know, mainly on his stick and move and maybe in just one or two gears. It was the best version of Michael Conlon that I'd ever seen. And I didn't really have a horse in that race. I didn't have a strong favorite. So I knew it was a good matchup, like a matchup in terms of how the featherweight's abilities meshed up. You know, I think most of us knew that Wood had the physical strength, that he had the punching power, that he was the more aggressive fighter, and that Conlon, he had the Olympic background, he had the amateur pedigree. He was going to be the boxer in the matchup. But in my mind, I thought that Conlon would stink it out. And I was favoring Conlon by a decision, but I didn't think it would be as compelling a matchup as it unfolded. I thought that Conlon would just be on his move. It would be a lot of lateral movement. It would be a lot of jabs and straight punches from the outside, and that he would limit as much physical contact as he could with Lee Wood. And that's not what happened, obviously. He came out letting his hands go and scored that first round knockdown and really set the tone from there. So I was out, and when I got back, I was out of the house. I can't even remember what the function was. It was boxing related. But when I got back home, I actually watched it on my phone. I put it on my laptop, and I was eating, it was the 11th round had just started. So I saw the final two rounds, and you could already tell that it was like this amazing atmosphere in Nottingham. So I'm like, oh, okay. I must have missed a fight. Yeah, you can just tell with no context. And I didn't have any context. I wasn't like following on social media or anything. And I'm watching this fight, and I'm thinking, oh, well, Conlon is ahead, but he suffered a knockdown in the 11th round. And I thought it was iffy. I thought it was more of a slip. And then what happened in the 12th round happened. And just with like, whatever, four and a half minutes of watching that, I jumped up. I went, whoa, I was loud. My wife was from across the table. I think she was trying to talk to me. I wasn't listening to her. I'm like, oh, this fight just ended. I don't believe it. And almost as immediate as that elation and that instant excitement, there's concern for Conlon because you didn't see him on the broadcast. They weren't showing him. You saw him go through the ropes. You saw a crowd of people, and then you didn't see him at all. So you didn't know if his head hit the floor. And at that point, I'm tweeting, and I think I tweeted out, like, you know, that's always a danger in boxing. And I really wish commissions would pad the floors, because it's bad enough getting knocked out, but when you drop from the ring, if there's nobody there to catch you, that's, you know, conceivably another concussion.
It's rare, isn't it, when you see it? But when you see it, it's obviously dramatic. And Tom, obviously, the way that DAZN broadcast it, they kind of almost faded to black in the sense that there wasn't much update on Conlon. Apparently, you know, Michael obviously said in his interview with me for the Ring's website afterwards, you know, he was out in the ring, but then when he hit the floor, he was awake.
Yeah.
So kind of, we could have, you know, those fears could have been allayed had we gone to see something or someone being reported to saying that, you know, he's conscious. But obviously, it was like he took that shot. His body went limp and he went into the abyss, and there was radio darkness. Yeah. So obviously there was a bit of concern. But in terms of what Dougie said, and obviously missing the start of the fight, you obviously thought it was going to be a barn burner. You wrote about that and you thought it could be a classic. But I spoke to Ben Davison the week before and he said, you know, there was this school of thought, which I hadn't heard, but that Conlon wins on points and Lee Wood wins by stoppage. The thing is, you know, 90 seconds left. And we kind of thought if Lee Wood was going to win by stoppage, it would have happened by then, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt like most people did that Lee needed the knockout finish and he'd built up the momentum, even though the knockdown was suspect in the 11th, the volume and the way that he was, I mean, Conlon was throwing enough punches and Lee was always finding a way to double the output. And I had a good conversation with Hannah Rankin, who's WBA champion. And what she said, in a fight like that, Conlon's style looks magnificent, like Doug says, gives a lot of movement, but he expends a lot of himself by doing that. And with all that movement combined with furious bursts of punches in every single round, his engine, you know, was running out of fuel a lot quicker than Lee's was in the championship rounds. And ultimately, I mean, he timed it perfect. I mean, he left it ultra, ultra late to get finish. But yeah, I think he just had a lot more left in the tank than Conlon did to that point. I thought he was running on fumes.
You guys obviously know your onions, and it was there's been obviously a lot of people talk about late dramatic finales in championship fights through the years. Obviously, you go back to Jake LaMotta against Lauren Dortier, and you know countless other really late shows. But obviously, the most famous of all, I would say now in the landscape of boxing, is obviously Meldrick Taylor losing to Julio Cesar Chavez with a couple of seconds left. Yep. Dougie, is there any way that was, as you know, Lee Wood Conlon, does that belong in the same paragraph?
It's a similar type of fight. It wasn't the fighters weren't on the level of Chavez and Taylor. Chavez and Taylor were elite junior welterweights. Julio Cesar Chavez was going on 80 consecutive wins. He had been a champion at 130 pounds and 135 pounds. And he'd beaten the best of the best in three weight classes. And then he was taking on an Olympic gold medalist who would look sensational, who had won his first world title at 140 pounds against a sensational boxer named Buddy McGirt. So these guys were proven on a much higher level. I would say Chavez Taylor was an elite level fight. I don't mean to be dismissive when I say Conlon Wood was a domestic level fight, but it was a British domestic level fight of the highest order. And I should mention that Lee Wood had proven himself to be world class coming into this fight against Zhu Kan, another 12th round stoppage. He seems to be one of those fighters where he has heavy hands, but he doesn't have enough pop on his shots, or he doesn't have the type of puncher's mentality where he's going to go out and get an early stoppage. He's not one to score, at least on the world-class level. He's not one to score a one-punch knockout, but he's a technician and he's busy. And without trying, all of his punches are heavy enough to where if you try to fight him, you're going to be pulled, whether you like it or not, into a battle of attrition. And he will just gradually wear you down. And I think those fighters, those are special type of fighters. And really that's the type of fighter that Julio Cesar Chavez was. He was a grinder. He didn't score a lot of early round knockouts, especially when he went up in weight, but he was the kind of guy who would break his opposition down. And those fighters are really, I think they're compelling to watch.
Hey, Tom, that was kind of a jarring assessment from Dougie in terms of levels, obviously, when you look at these guys' backstories. And obviously, that shows a lot about the boxing landscape. We don't really often get these fighters meeting at their primes. Obviously, now, you know, it's all about, you know, meeting when the price is right rather than when the fight is right, really. But, Tom, obviously, with what you said about Conlon expending his energy, it was the same as Taylor in the sense that Taylor had all that success early against Chavez, but he paid such a heavy price to get those shots off and to be in range all that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And Chavez had obviously went the 12 rounds a lot more often, was battle hardened. So he knows that he is always in the fight until the last second, whereas Meldrick Taylor was probably feeding a lot off of nervous energy, just getting to the finish line, and ultimately took too big a chance in the 12th round. He could have easily stunk that out and made it past. But the warrior Philadelphia Pride wouldn't allow him to do that, which was ultimately his undoing. Can I just say, by the way, because I get into trouble during the week, Doug, that was a Britain versus Ireland fight. If you mention that Michael Conlan is British, we get into trouble because we put him ratings.
Yeah,
we put him on the ratings as from the UK and I had to get it changed. So yeah, Britain versus Ireland. But just going back to that, I felt that the reason that we could be in for such an electric atmosphere and occasion which would coalesce in the ring is because of the Irish fans who go crazy for the fighters. And Lee Wood in Nottingham, which has probably not had as much of a reason to celebrate since the heyday of Carol Froch. I felt when those two fan bases came together, plus there was a lot of smack talk in the way up and the lead up to the fight. Sometimes a fight that you expect not to catch fire does. And I felt that that fight had a lot going for it. That's the reason why I thought we could see something dramatic, but still I didn't expect it to be that dramatic.
Yeah, but you called it on just the complexion of the bout, and I wasn't expecting that at all. And, you know, hindsight is 20/20. You could go to Conlan and say you fought the wrong fight. If you fought a little bit more technical, if you were a little more safety first minded, maybe you win a decision. Maybe you don't wear down and maybe he doesn't catch you. But
Dougie,
let me just say this.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, this is the first time I'm watching Michael Conlan and thinking this guy is legit world class. Like the fact that he took the fight in spots to Wood. I saw more of his game. I saw the inside game for the first time.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he had it previously, but against, you know, a lesser caliber foe. And I saw the body work. And I got a better appreciation for his sense of distance, his control of distance and his timing. So for the first time, as I'm watching this fight unfold, when I did sit down and watch all 12 rounds, I'm looking at Conlan with different eyes. I'm looking at him and knowing that he lost, knowing that he got knocked the F out.
Yeah.
But I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, hey, this guy is a world-class featherweight. This guy, has something.
Yeah, I mean, let me add to that a couple of things. I think you mentioned Conlan's body work. I think Ben Davison was hacked off that Lee Wood didn't get the credit for his body work because there was plenty of him from going on throughout that fight. So I think it's well worth acknowledging that. I think the other thing about Conlan, what I think is worth noting is a lot of fighters want to get 12 rounds under their belt before they step up in class. And I get that. And I remember David Haye doing it against, I think, a really tough dude, Ismail Abdul, maybe. And he did what he wanted when he wanted for 12 rounds. And that's not the same as having a 12 round fight. Do you know what I mean? Like if you help go in, help yourself, move around, do what you want for 3 minutes of a round.
Right.
That's not the same. So Conlan has had a 10 round fights, and he's gone the distance. But he's not had anything like that before.
Right.
And, you know, and you can tell in the interview I did with Michael, which, as I said, is up on the Ring website. You know, he said, you don't want many of these fights in your career. You know, they take a lot out of you and stuff that you don't get back from this fight with Lee Wood. So I think it's worth acknowledging that in the sense that Conlan had gone rounds before, but there's a big difference between going rounds, picking your shots, picking and choosing when you want to engage and all the rest of it. So
you need a hard, you need a hard 10 rounds of resistance. You need that type of opponent. You don't need an opponent that's just tough enough to take you the distance. When you're gearing up for your first shot at glory, your first shot at a world title, your first shot at a name fighter who's battle tested, and you know you're not battle tested, you need to have what the old timers used to call a gut check under your belt, at least one of them. And you used to see that on a regular basis with developing fighters. And Riddick Bowe comes to mind. His management, just mainly Rock Newman, who's sort of like a manager and promoter, he made sure he had at least one 10 rounder before Bowe challenged Evander Holyfield. And one of those 10 rounders was against a tricky opponent, a tricky former champion named Tony Tubbs. And it was a close fight, actually. It was sort of a dangerous fight stylistically because Tubbs was so ring savvy and so slick and so skillful. But Riddick Bowe got the decision. It was a close one, but Bowe got the decision. So that was one step. But before Rock Newman, pulled the trigger, and sort of enforce that sort of that challenge of Bo against Holyfield. I think they got a South African fighter who wasn't able to last the distance with Bo, but they knew he would fight Bo, and that Bo, it would be physical, because Holyfield, despite his size being like barely 200 pounds, they knew he was a dog. They knew he was a pit bull. They knew it was going to be a fight, and it was going to be a physical struggle at some point. And I'm spacing out on the South African's name. I remember he looked
Pierre
like
Coetzee. Pierre Coetzee?
Pierre Coetzee. I think that was it. Yeah, he had a big walrus Fu Manchu sort of style mustache. And he was just tough. I mean, he wasn't talented. He wasn't a technician, but he was actually going to fight you. So you need that. And you used to see this on a regular basis, like with Oscar De La Hoya fighting John Molina, you know, a former champion, a skillful guy, but also a guy who could be rough in there. Somebody who was going to take De La Hoya rounds, and he took De La Hoya 12 rounds, but also rough him up a little bit and frustrate him. And these are growing experiences.
Yeah,
I mean, I contend that in the modern game, no one had better gut checks and experiences than Ricky Hatton. When you think he was on the floor against Eamon McGee, he was cut against John Thaxton.
Oh, yeah.
He felt Vince Phillips's power. He boxed southpaws, he boxed tall guys, he boxed short guys. Yeah. He'd done the whole lot. And, you know, by the time he fought Kostya Zou, you can't think of anything he hadn't experienced.
Well, I've got one the other way, though. What about Jack Catterall? Jack Catterall's just went out, right, for most of us, defeated a top 5 pound for pound entrant. And Jack, I went down to see Jamie Moore when we were giving Chantel Cameron her Ring Magazine championship. And at this point, I'm thinking that Josh has got that fight locked up. I haven't encountered anyone that thinks that Jack Catterall's got a significant chance. And the way that Jamie Moore put it to me was, look, the biggest argument I'm hearing against Jack is that he has never campaigned at this level before. And what he said was, fair enough, but just because he's never been at that level under the lights doesn't mean to say he can't contend with it when the bell rings. So I think that's an example the opposite way. That Jack, I mean, honestly, right now, I mean, he had a British Championship fight. He had never been at anything resembling Josh Taylor's level. He'd also been woefully inactive. So I think that for the most part, what we're saying is true, but there has been instances, and that's just one of them, where you're able to rise to the occasion if your ability allows you to do so.
Absolutely. If you're a special talent, and if you have a strong enough amateur background, and you have, you know, whether your talent is otherworldly athletic, like a Roy Jones Jr. or Sugar Shane Mosley, you could step up to that first title fight, not having fought any legitimate contenders.
Yeah, but no one would have had Jack Catterall on that plane, so to speak, coming into that fight.
No,
which was actually,
no, no.
Which
was I was going to say the other side of that is being technically sound, being somebody like, you know, Floyd Mayweather, you know what I mean? Like, he didn't fight anybody Genaro Hernandez's level before stepping in there with Genaro Hernandez. Yeah. He was totally ready, you know? So obviously there's other factors, you know what I mean? If the champion is getting long in the tooth, struggling to make weight, combination of both,
and Josh,
whatever,
and Josh's
that's
case.
That kind of, yeah, that helps. Yeah, that helps.
Okay. Well, let's take this on a little bit further in the sense that, I mean, you mentioned Catterall there. I mean, I'll just mention this. I know we don't really talk about other governing sanctioning bodies too much. Obviously, the WBO have pulled out and said that Catterall is now number 3 in their rankings, which is just an embarrassment for the sport, but nothing that we're not used to. But in terms of good rankings, ring rankings, Wood and Conlon, both, well, Wood's gone up in the pecking order, and Conlon's entered off a defeat. Tom, in your time at the ring, remember anything like that?
No. And it was actually yourself that brought it up. Excuse me. It was actually yourself that brought it up, and I agreed with it straight away. It crossed my mind. I just felt that the rest of the panel, and maybe I shouldn't have done that when I think about it. If it's a democracy, it goes through bottom line. But I figured that it would not be accepted. But I was so pleased to see that it was. I felt that Lee deserved his 4-spot jump from number 8 to number 4. There was insanity briefly with people talking about keeping Gary Russell rated above him, which would have been criminal. And I think that to echo what Doug said, he was, you know, Conlon fought like a world-class featherweight. The eye test told you that. The success had told you that. The early round knockdown, you know, gutting it out on the inside, just amazing exchanges. Some of the stuff in the 10th and the 11th, and no, there is no comparison with pound-for-pound entrants like Chavez and Meredith Taylor. But what you were watching in the championship rounds, I felt was world-class combat. I mean, I was out of my chair watching it. I wasn't even ringside. So, yep, I felt as if Michael deserved his moment in the ring ratings, and I felt as if Lee Wood deserved the jump.
Yeah, and Doug, let me put this to you. I mean, obviously, you know, in terms of Conlon coming into the rankings off a defeat, I think it's really important that we at the ring show that, you know, as long as you fight and give it your all at a good level, you're not going to go down in our estimation. You know, this thing about the unbeaten record and guys wanting to hold on to their W and stuff. If you guys put it out there, you could still get rewarded for it, right?
Right. I think it sends a message. And I think the message is more important than the win or the loss. And we understand that sports is about excelling. It's about winning, especially professional sports. It's about winning, but the wins or the losses only have as much merit as the quality of the opposition and the quality of the event, the game, or in this case, the fight. And I think it's way more important to look at who a fighter is in the ring with, what level that fighter is, and what transpires once the bell rings. And if what we're seeing is world-class competition on both sides, once that bell rings, the fighter who is ranked, who wins, obviously is going to advance. But the fighter who proves himself to be world-class, if he's not ranked, he should be ranked. He should be top 10, depending on who comprises that top 10. Now, there are some weight classes. Some weight classes are deeper than others. Some weight classes, you know, you get down to the number 7 or number 8 contender, and you're talking about, you know, 2 division world champions and so forth, you know, or former unified title holders, and you know, but at featherweight, you could make an argument. You could make an argument that Colin, he deserves to be in there. And I'm glad that you brought that up, Tris, because I think there's certain lines of thinking that I think sometimes hampers rankings. And one of them is just looking at the loss, just looking at the official result and not looking at what actually transpired in the ring. Another mind block, in my opinion, is, refusing to rank a fighter over a fighter who had beaten him in a previous contest, no matter how long ago it was. You know, we have panelists that won't allow a fighter to be ranked above a fighter who beat him 6 years ago, 2 weight classes lighter. And I think in time, a fighter who loses to an opponent can surpass that opponent if that fighter is fighting the better opposition and accomplishing more things. And you have to look at what they accomplished in a specific division. We're talking about the divisional rankings. We're not talking about the pound for pound rankings. And then the other one is looking at a fighter who's ranked ahead of a fighter and saying, well, I can't rank this guy ahead of this guy because I think in a head-to-head matchup, the fighter ranked ahead of him would beat him. And that's conceptual. I don't think you should do that. You know, the ranking should be based solely on one's accomplishments in a particular division, period.
Yeah, that was one of, you know, when I was the editor of Boxing News, that was one of the things that I was constantly coming up against, people basing rankings off potential. And, you know, that, you know, potential doesn't pay the bills. You know, it is what it is. Guys, we're going to be heading into the championship rounds of this podcast in the next few seconds. So I wanted to get you to pick your brains on something I haven't had the privilege of seeing yet, but it's the latest issue with Larry Holmes as the cover star. Tom, I know that you've had the reins on some of this, and you've got a copy right there, which must be mine, and about to head south. Tell me, what was the high point of putting that issue together?
I think it was, we'd spoken about it a few times, like, special issues will come into your head. And I think it was Doug's idea to pull the trigger on it at this point, because we're getting very close to the 40th anniversary of Holmesy's title defence against Jerry Cooney, which from memory, June 12th, 1982.
Yeah.
So perfect time in that sense. I've been interviewing Larry Holmes for the best part of a decade. The first one that I actually did, I think you took it off me for Boxing News many, many years ago. So in terms of high points, it's just, you know, spending time talking to him. I mean, it doesn't matter. I've probably interviewed him a dozen times, but, you know, it doesn't matter how many times I speak to him. It's as surreal as it was the last time. You know, I love him dearly. He's one of my favorite heavyweight champions. My second favorite heavyweight of all time behind Ali. Hopefully he forgives me for saying that. But I got a chance to speak to him.
Sorry, let me ask, in terms of the ring's coverage of Larry, when you look back in the day, was Larry popular? Did the ring give him a fair shake? Did they give him his dues?
During his title reign?
Yeah.
They recognized him. They recognized his dominance. You know, there was, you know, he was the WBC title holder for a number of years, from 78 until, I think, 1984.
83.
Is that right? Or 1983. And when he was stripped of that title, or just let it go, and was immediately awarded the IBF title, and the International Boxing Federation was brand new. Nobody had heard of him. Nobody blinked. Nobody said, oh, well, he's holding a paper. Nobody considered Larry Holmes to be a paper title holder. Everybody knew that he was the Ring Magazine champion. He was the lineal champion. He was the best heavyweight on the planet. And meanwhile, the WBC title that he had previously held and the WBA title, they were passed around like hot potatoes, you know, between Don King's huge stable of heavyweights. And he was never beloved. I'll say this. He wasn't beloved in his time, in his prime. And I hate to say it, I was one of these people. And in my defense, I was a child and an adolescent during his title reign, but he had defeated my hero. Muhammad Ali is my number one heavyweight. He's the reason I forged an interest into boxing. But I was bitter towards Larry, and I wanted, my ideal of a heavyweight champion was Ali, and I didn't realize nobody could compare to Ali. But I felt like the heavyweight champion should try to be more of a people person, more personable, more affable, more accessible. And Larry was Larry. But, you know, in retrospect, Larry wasn't that bad. You know what I mean? He just wasn't Ali. He was in the shadow, and he was held to an impossible standard. And on top of that, he beat an old and faded Ali, and people were resentful for that. And yeah, by people, I'm just talking about fans. I think sports writers had a healthy respect for him, and boxing writers had a love-hate relationship with Larry, because Larry could be salty, he could be caustic. He was always leery of being disrespected, and if you thought you were being disrespectful to him, he would speak up. And so boxing writers in the past did not like that. So I think he wasn't always treated fairly. But I think when he went away for a couple of years and came back in his 40s, especially after he beat Ray Mercer, I think people, they respected him. They didn't just respect him. They enjoyed him. They enjoyed his presence, and they appreciated him in retrospect.
Tom, let me ask you this then. You know, how, because Larry Holmes now is revered as one of the great heavyweights, I think. Most people have him in top 10. Lots of people,
top including five. Yourself,
have him in top five. Exactly. Yeah. How did he get rid of being the placeholder? Because I hate to say it, but for the longest period of time, people said he was the guy who had the belt post Ali, pre Tyson.
Right.
How's history shifted?
Well, I think because the amount of time that's elapsed. So he was champion for the last time in 85. So then you've got championship reigns beyond that. Now you've got good reigns. You've got Evander Holyfield had a good time, although it was kind of choppy. Lennox Lewis was a long-reigning champion. The Klitschko brothers come along, and for many people, perhaps sucked a bit of excitement out of the division. Obviously, the Tyson era as well. But I think when you look back at what Holmes did, it's very similar to Joe Louis's reign, and it's this amazing longevity. Now, a lot of people that probably have got no idea really about Holmes's career will try and pick it apart. But I don't care if you've not got like the gold standard, you've not got like the golden era of heavyweights at the time when Holmes was fighting to consistently beat guys, you know, 3-4 times a year, you know, one, and for a lot of that, he was barely losing rounds. He had 8 consecutive knockouts and title defenses after dethroning Ken Norton, which I think ended up being a record at the time, or it drew with the record, Tommy Burns. You know, he was a really, really terrific champion, and time becomes a great healer. You know, people look back and forgive him for, you know, picking apart Ali, which he had no choice. Ali banged the drum for that fight. What was he meant to do? Like, walk away in another direction? If he does that, his reputation is in tatters completely. But getting back to your initial question, Chris, as well, about how the ring perceived him. In 1978, Ali fought Spinks twice, and sandwiched between that was the Holmes-Norton fight, which to me, other than Ali Frazier won in Manila, is probably as good a heavyweight championship fight as you could ever see. At the end of 1978, Ring Magazine named Ali Fighter of the Year for essentially, if we're being completely honest here, beating a guy for a third championship he should never have lost to in the first place. And Ali Spinks 1 was named Fight of the Year. And if you go back and look at Ali Spinks 1, try and convince yourself that that's a better fight than Holmes against Norton. Or, by the way, in round 15 was Round of the Year instead of Holmes-Norton round 15. So he wasn't appreciated during his time. He was very, very cognizant of that and would get spiky. When I first met him, I sat down with him to interview him for The Ring. And my lead-off question, which in retrospect wasn't very wise, was, are you happy that you're getting respected now, that this, you know, that being ignored is in the past, and you know, people look at your career so favourably now and you're looked at as an all-time great? And his opening words to me were, I don't give an F what people think. Right in my eyes, which didn't make me feel comfortable for a few seconds, but I turned it around. But that's the way he is. He believes in his heart that he's as good as Ali, Frazier, Foreman, Tyson, any of them, and I don't blame him for that.
He should, yeah. Yeah, one thing about, like, I ignored his reign, you know, most of his prime, but even when he started to slide a little bit and have difficult title defenses against the likes of Tim Witherspoon or Carl the Truth Williams, I didn't watch either of the Spinks bouts. And I started, you know, I kind of faded away from boxing, but in 1987, you know, Mike Tyson was the champion, and he was rolling with incredible momentum, and my boyhood idol Sugar Ray Leonard returned to challenge Marvelous Marvin Hagler. And I was back paying attention to boxing. And by 1990 or 91, I'm a hardcore fan. And suddenly I want to catch up on all that boxing that I missed. And when I started to find VHS tapes of Holmes's, you know, previous title defenses, especially that Tim Witherspoon fight, there's a level of appreciation I gained that, you know, I always respected his skills. I always expected, you know, his ability to impose his style on his opponent, but I didn't really understand, because I hadn't seen the Ken Norton fight. I didn't understand how tough he was. I didn't understand the type of grit that he had, the warrior that he was, what he could fight through. So it was great to see him in those, you know, fights where he's dropped, like Ronaldo Snipes, get dropped hard and get up, and you know he's hurt. And he's not just trying to survive. He's able to survive because he has those skills, but he's always trying to get his respect. He was always trying to get his respect out of the ring, but always convincing his opponent, like, you better respect me. Even if I'm hurt, don't think you can walk me down, bro.
The common thread between both of your stories about Larry is stubbornness. You know, stubbornness that he wasn't accepted, but he deserved to be there. Stubbornness in the way that he fought, in the sense that he was underrated because he refused to give an inch to anybody in or out of the ring. But yeah, I mean, an absolutely outstanding champion, who's also, by the way, it's gone under the radar, has done a lot for older fighters and retired fighters. We talk about these guys wanting or needing help in retirement. This is a guy who's put on golf days in Eastern and all over Pennsylvania and run after dinner speeches. And I remember going to one gathering that he'd assembled more than 20 years ago in somewhere in rural Pennsylvania. And there was Harry Arroyo, Iron Barkley, numerous guys that were getting the benefit of spending the evening with Larry Holmes, looking after them and making sure they got the credit they deserve. So Larry, a true champ, in and out of the ring. Guys, I want to wrap this up by you agreeing for 30 odd seconds with a statement each. Tom, I'm going to start with you, and you have 30 seconds to agree with this. And the winner of this, right, agreeing with this outrageous statement, is going to be 1-0 up in our outrageous argument debate. Okay, so Tom, in 30 seconds, you have to say why Larry Holmes was actually massively overrated. All he had was the jab, and his best win was over an old butterbean. Go.
Well, as I'd said earlier, Larry Holmes had 8 consecutive knockouts and heavyweight title defences after beating Ken Norton. His fight against Tim Witherspoon, I think, is the best heavyweight championship fight of the 1980s. His consistency was amazing, was never out of shape. Jab is the best in heavyweight history, including Muhammad Ali and Joe Lewis and Sonny Liston, Doug. And yeah, I think he was the entire package. Very, very underrated.
We'll have to redo this, and we'll have to do this. You had to agree that it was an outrageous statement saying that he was overrated. Not underrated.
Tom's not wired to do that with Holmes.
That's such an unfair question. Right, listen, we'll edit.
Because I became
so accustomed to talking nice about him that it's completely threw me for a loop.
Do you want to give it another go?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I do.
Okay, ready? So listen, you got to listen in, okay?
Right, okay?
Larry Holmes was overrated. All he had was the jab, and his best win was over an old butterbean. Go.
Okay. right, okay. Basically, he's followed hot in the heels of Muhammad Ali, could never match Ali in the charisma department, could never match Ali with the jab, had no heavyweight rivalries to speak of. It was all just these guys that were, either overrated, has-beens or never-wears. The jab was overrated. It's the worst jab in heavyweight history. And yeah, Butterbean at the end of the day, look at the size and the shape of Butterbean, and Holmes was able to out jab him and win a 10 round points decision. That is definitely
okay. Right, I'm actually gonna cut this bit and play it to Larry next time.
you got set up, Tom.
Oh god.
Right, hit Doug, okay. We want to see how he deals with us.
Yes, yeah, so again. No, given who's on your T-shirt, this one actually fits the bill. Larry Holmes was underrated. He would have schooled Muhammad Ali on Muhammad Ali's best day.
Larry Holmes had the size of a modern heavyweight. I know Muhammad Ali was almost 6'3", or maybe he was 6'3", had the reach. Holmes had that height and that reach, but a body, a musculature, a physique and physiology that could carry more pounds. He had a sharper jab. His jab did more damage than Muhammad Ali's. I think he was just as good at controlling the distance. His right hand was just as accurate as Ali's.
Okay,
maybe a little bit more power on it.
Listen, I get that fitted more in. He was talking too slow.
Yeah, I was going to say, Dougie didn't have the same urgency as Tom, who was really scratching around. So I think for effort alone, Tom's going to get it this week.
Yeah, even though it was at the second time of asking.
Yeah, I think, you had a dry run, but also Dougie had a chance to listen to you go tremendously wrong and then also try to let it. But hey, I think, I always think it's interesting when you put someone on the spot and try it, because like you said, guys like us of our sort of age and vintage, we're used to being sort of defenders of people like Larry for getting the credit. These guys who didn't have the same highlight reels as a Mike Tyson, or who maybe didn't have the same social standing as a Muhammad Ali. Nothing wrong with that. Everyone's individual. Everyone's their own man. And Larry, if anything, he was his own man, right?
Yeah.
I'm glad that we did this special issue. It goes without saying, any publishing company, you want to put publications out there with the most popular individual on the cover, right? That's going to sell. That's what we're doing. We're in the business of selling magazines. So it's a no-brainer to do a special issue on Manny Pacquiao and Mike Tyson, or even Julio Cesar Chavez. They have huge dedicated fan bases that are going to guarantee magazine sales. A fighter like Larry Holmes, I'm very happy that we're giving him this recognition because he has his admirers. And I do think there are people who are maybe on the fence about his greatness who will read this issue and learn things about him and come to appreciate him and maybe go back and review his career and say, wow, you know, when I'm looking at it now, he defended against a lot of really good fighters. He showed skill, he showed grit, he showed, you know, he showed real championship elite level metal. And some of our previous specials, especially on the fighters that are gone too soon, passed away prematurely, like Marvin Hagler and Pernell Whitaker, tragic events. And it was sort of bittersweet. You know, obviously when these guys passed away, we immediately dropped what we were doing, whatever magazine, wherever we were in that magazine cycle, whatever we were working on, we shelved it and immediately put together special issues commemorating their lives and careers. And I'm proud of both the Whitaker and the Hagler special editions, but it was sad that these men didn't get to see this, you know, see all the wonderful things people said about them and all these great stories and anecdotes that we were able to compile. So it means something when we can do that to a living legend like Larry Holmes, somebody who's alive, who didn't get his due in his time. And although well-respected now, doesn't have like this huge fanatical fan base, like a Tyson or a Chavez or a Pacquiao. For him to be able to see this and hear people say wonderful things when they get their issue in the mail and they put it out there on social media, that's very satisfying for me. And I'm sure it is for Tom.
Jerry, yeah, absolutely. I'm really proud of it. As proud of it as I am of any of the specials in it, or any of the magazines that I've been involved in. We should also say that Jerry Cooney did the foreword for it, which says a lot about the sportsmanship and the friendship, I think, that's transpired since those guys shared the ring.
Yeah, and I mean, it's worth acknowledging, you guys said it's 40 years since they fought, and they're obviously good friends now. It's one of the enduring qualities of boxing now, this lifelong friendship that these guys had, these bitter rivals who were, you know, basically the heads of two different factions, shall I say, for want of a better word, back in the day. And now great friends, and they're actually on a speaking tour of the UK in a couple of months' time. So it's great that they're still close, and it's one of boxing's many redeeming qualities. Guys, I've really enjoyed this. It's been a great way to kick off this new show that we're doing each week, and it will be dropping at the same time every week. I'm Tris Dixon. This has been Dougie Fisher and Tom Gray, and we'll be back next week.